tomorrow at 11 o'clock in the morning in Ives 214. Now, I would like to spend the first part of the hour today on concluding our discussion of Locke and begin a discussion of Emerson. Some of you have asked me questions concerning the implementation of some of the ideas of Locke. For example, and a central question, what happens, according to Locke, if the government violates the natural rights of citizens, natural rights which they have never given up, and with respect to which the government has no authority? Now, at the time that Locke wrote the second treatise, there were no fixed checks and balances in England, in the government of England. And the whole idea of institutionalizing checks and balances didn't arise until later. Throughout the period of the Middle Ages, political theorists gave a lot of thought to the problem of what to do when a king becomes a tyrant, a despot, when a government violates the rights of men. They struggled with the problem, and they were never able to evolve institutions which would have built into them checks and balances. We have the problem in the minds of many Americans today, with respect to the impounding of funds, for example, by the president. Does the president have the right, without exercising his constitutional power of vetoing a measure, and then Congress would have a chance to override the veto, which it might succeed in doing or not succeed in doing? But these are the constitutional methods. The Constitution says nothing about impounding, which means that the president, in effect, has a veto which Congress does not have an opportunity to override. So it falls outside of the institutionalization of the limits that are imposed by the Constitution on each of the branches of the government. And that problem has not yet been resolved, but it's a problem such as the one that we are concerned with, that our institutionalization has not yet been perfected. There are always ways of skinning a cat, and people will resort to devices to achieve that. The problem of executive privilege is another example. Congress recognizes that there is a check on itself insofar as the integrity of the person of the president's own counsel is concerned, as an order not to limit him in seeking advice and counsel. He may not be questioned about his thinking on a subject or what he said to someone whom he talked to on a subject. That person may not be asked questions as to what the president asked him or what the president said to him. The Congress recognizes that as a legitimate check on itself. But when the president tries to extend that to the whole executive department, including postmasters, anybody, 2.5 million employees, anyone whom he could instruct not to answer questions put to him by Congress, whether that person talked to the president or not, had any relations with the president or not, but as a member of the executive department, that raises a question which the Constitution doesn't provide for. So that we have not, in our own system, which is a more intricate, more highly institutionalized system than you will find anywhere else in the world. Our Constitution broke fresh ground in political theory and in political practice when the idea of separation of powers and checks and balances were built into the framework of the government and of the Constitution. But still, new questions do come up and new problems come up, and we try to face them. But these are simply, cite these as simply examples of the kinds of problems which hundreds of years later have developed. But at the time of Locke, there hadn't even been a beginning towards the solution of such problems. The only thing that was happening was that Parliament was moving into a position of supreme power. And Locke provided in the Second Treatise, which again comes up in our own day here in the conflict between Congress and the President, that the legislative power shall be supreme. That is, that Parliament shall be supreme over the King. And the beginning towards that end was seen in the selection of William and Mary and their agreement to abide by a kind of an unwritten constitution, since Parliament offered the crown to William and Mary, so that William and Mary didn't have any rights to the crown, but Parliament gave them the crown, so that the historical setting was one which allowed Parliament to make claims of superiority. But with respect to anything beyond that claim of superiority, it was left to history to develop the problems and the solutions, partial or whole, to the problems as they came up. Now, the idea of the legislative power being supreme comes up in our own time here in the conflict between Congress and the President, because Congress says that the theory of the Constitution is that Congress shall be supreme. Now, how does Congress arrive at that? It arrives at it in the same way which Locke did, and it's very interesting to see that. As we have to have a rule of law, says Locke. Now, what does that mean? That means that there must be a law on a subject, a law that applies in general terms to cover a problem, to cover a situation. Now, where does the king come in? He executes the law. And this, of course, is exactly what is being claimed today. Congress makes the laws. Congress makes the appropriations. Congress defines public policy with respect to housing, with respect to anything else. And what do we need the president for? We need the president because someone has to execute the law. So his powers are secondary. They are derivative. Otherwise, if he himself originates law, then there is no rule of law. There's the rule of a man. And in terms of contemporary political theory, it means the rule of a dictator. And that, of course, has aroused even some very staunch, loyal Republicans in Congress. They don't want to see that development. Now, nobody says that this is exactly what President Nixon has in mind, but it is being spelled out as being a legitimate implication in the position that he has taken. And so it is very interesting to see what the conflict looks like today in terms of the history of political theory as it has developed over the centuries. And it gives you a much deeper insight and a dimension which would otherwise be lacking, and a dimension which I think is absolutely essential in order to see the problem for what it is. Now, when we go back to Locke and see what he tried to do in terms of his own situation given the year 1689 or 1690, he says that ultimately, when the government violates fundamental liberties and there doesn't seem to be any help, any solution, then the people themselves have to make the decision, and they have to appeal to God to help them, as they are in a revolutionary situation. The second social contract, as it were, not the original one, the state is intact, but the government now offers a threat, so that the second contract, the second agreement, seems to perhaps verge on dissolution. In such a situation, the people have to look after their own interests. And he has the phrase which has become very famous, the people shall judge. They're the ones who have to make the ultimate decision. In section 240 of the second treatise, who shall be judge whether the prince or legislative act contrary to their trust? This perhaps ill-affected and factious men may spread among the people when the prince only makes use of his due prerogative. To this I reply, the people shall be judge. For who shall be judge whether the trustee or deputy acts well and according to the trust reposed in him, but he who deputes him, and must, by having deputed him, have still the power to discard him when he fails in his trust, as government is always only a trustee. It acts only as the agent. Therefore, the people are the principal, on whose behalf the agent acts. In an agency situation, there are always two parties. There's the principal and the agent. The people are the principal. They're the ones who must ultimately make the decision as to whether or not the agent carries out the trust. If this be reasonable in particular cases of private men, this is certainly true in the private world, why should it be otherwise? In that of the greatest moment where the welfare of millions is concerned, and also where the evil, if not prevented, is greater, and the redress very difficult, dear and dangerous. But farther, this question, who shall be judge, cannot mean that there is no judge at all, for where there is no judicature on earth to decide controversies amongst men, God in heaven is judge. He alone, it is true, is judge of the right, but every man is judge for himself, as in all other cases, so in this, whether another has put himself into a state of war with him, and whether he should appeal to the supreme judge, that is, to God. So ultimately, each man who is a party to the contract, to the agreement, must himself decide on whether or not the agent or the trustee violates the agreement. Section 225. He talks about revolutions. Such revolutions happen not upon every little mismanagement of public affairs, as the grievance must be very great, great mistakes in the ruling part, many wrong and inconvenient laws, and all the slips of human frailty will be borne by people without mutiny or murmur, as we all have to put up with a lot of nonsense, with infractions. Justice Holmes said a long time ago, every machine has its frictions. Human beings cannot expect perfection, so an awful lot is tolerated. But if a long train of abuses, lies, and artifices, all tending the same way, make the design visible to the people, and they cannot but feel what they lie under and see whither they are going, it is not to be wondered that they should then rouse themselves and endeavor to put the rule into such hands which may secure to them the ends for which government was at first created, and without which ancient names and specious forms are so far from being better that they are much worse than the state of nature or pure anarchy. That is, a time comes when people must disregard the nice facade that the government presents, and they judge whether or not the state of nature or even pure anarchy might not be better than to have this kind of a government. In that kind of a situation, you have a revolution. It's a revolutionary situation. Now, of course, a lot hinges on the very important concept of the government being a trustee. Locke didn't originate the idea, but he certainly emphasized it and presented it in the context of a larger philosophy, the larger philosophy of natural law, natural rights, and of men retaining their natural rights so that they, unlike Hobbes, have not given up their rights. With Hobbes, the king cannot do any wrong because all power is vested in him. People have no rights except the rights that are recognized, that are given by the government. But where people retain rights, then the concept of trusteeship comes naturally and becomes significant, becomes meaningful. And it is certainly that in the case of Locke's theory. In section 149, he says that the legislative, being only a fiduciary power, as a trust power, to act for certain ends, there remains still in the people a supreme power to remove or alter the legislative when they find that the legislative act contrary to the trust reposed in them. For all power given with trust for attaining an end, being limited by that end, whenever that end is manifestly neglected or opposed, the trust must necessarily be forfeited, and the power devolve into the hands of those that gave it, who may place it anew where they shall think best for their safety and security. Which, of course, is what the English people did in 1689. They withdrew the power from James II and vested it in the hands of William and Mary. The people will always have a right to preserve what they have not a power to part with. They have not a power to part with their natural rights, their basic human rights. And so they always have the right to preserve those rights, because they have no power to part with them, and to rid themselves of those who invade this fundamental, sacred, and unalterable law. And thus the community may be said in this respect to be always the supreme power. And finally, on this head, section 221, there is therefore another way whereby governments are dissolved, and that is when the legislative or the prince, that is, or the executive, either of them act contrary to their trust. The reason why men enter into society is the preservation of their property, property in the broad sense of including rights and liberties, as you will recall, and the end why they choose and authorize the legislative is that there may be laws and rules set as guards and as fences to the properties of all the members of society, to limit the power and moderate the dominion of every part and member of the society. That's the purpose of law. That's the purpose for leaving the state of nature and entering into civil society. For since it can never be supposed to be the will of the society that the legislative should have a power to destroy that which everyone designs secure by entering into society, and for which the people submitted themselves to legislators of their own making, whenever the legislators endeavor to take away and destroy the property of the people, or to reduce them to slavery under arbitrary power, they put themselves into a state of war with the people. It's very easy to see the theory once you get the hang of his language, and he's quite consistent. He follows through the elements of his theory with daring, and of course this is why Locke has captured the minds and the interests of people through the centuries, and will continue to do so. Now, there is also, in addition to revolution, according to Locke, there is another recourse that people may have, and that is civil disobedience. And this he states in the Letter on Toleration. And it's very interesting when you think back how many centuries ago this was done, that Locke was able to foreshadow a theory and practice of civil disobedience. This is what he says. But some may ask, what if the magistrate, that is the government, should enjoin anything by his authority that appears unlawful to the conscience of a private person? Now there you have the classic question involving, of course, civil disobedience. This is what, in every case involving civil disobedience, is the question. What happens if the government requires anything that appears unlawful to the conscience? Now, it's not merely a matter of convenience, not merely a matter of one's reasoning. You argue it back and forth. There are reasons on one side, reasons on the other. This deals with the conscience, and this is why this appears in the Letter on Toleration, where it rightly belongs. I answer that if government be faithfully administered and the counsels of the magistrates be indeed directed to the public good, this will seldom happen. But if, perhaps, it do so fall out, I say that such a private person is to abstain from the action that he judges unlawful, and he is to undergo the punishment which it is not unlawful for him to bear. It's exactly what Gandhi said centuries later. What's he to do? Abstain from the action which the citizens to abstain from the action which he considers unlawful, as unlawful in terms of his conscience, and then undergo the punishment which it is not unlawful for him to bear. For the private judgment of any person concerning a law enacted in political matters for the public good does not take away the obligation of that law, nor deserve a dispensation. As if the law is adopted for what the legislature believes to be the public good, it need not and will not make an exception in favor of somebody who believes that the action will be against his conscience. But if the law indeed be concerning things that lie not within the verge of the government's authority, for example, where it compels a person to embrace a strange religion or join in the worship and ceremonies of another man's church, men are not in these cases obliged by that law against their consciences. For the political society is instituted for no other end but only to secure every man's possessions of the things of this life, the care of each man's soul, and of the things of heaven, which neither does belong to the commonwealth nor can be subjected to the commonwealth, is left entirely to every man's self. Now, of course, he didn't anticipate the kinds of problems that people have today, where they do exercise the duty, or try to fulfill the duty, as they see it, of civil disobedience. But he thought about the problem deeply enough, as you see, to have come up with the essential heart of the policy of a person who faces the predicament which Locke discusses. So, in the final result, you have, according to Locke, two situations. One is where there's a revolutionary situation created, and then it becomes a matter for the people. Howsoever the people constitute an entity, there's no way of institutionalizing the people. But in theory, this is the situation, and in history, certainly this happens time and again, that the people do get involved in a revolution. And the second is where the individual conscience comes into play, and the individual himself must take a position. It's not a revolutionary situation. It doesn't involve anybody but himself. And other people like him, similarly constituted, who think the way that he does. But an important distinction does exist, and Locke recognizes that, between a revolution and an action of civil disobedience. Now, a final word about Locke. The basic belief, it should be apparent by now, that seems to have been operative in Locke, was that man has a moral sense and has moral principles, and ultimately politics is subject to morality. In a state of nature, a man has morality. He has moral principles. He takes them with him into civil society. In the state of nature, he has no politics. That's the state of nature. That's what makes it a state of nature rather than a political society. He forms a political society, but he hasn't given up his moral principles. So they continue to function. And ultimately, he must judge political actions. By what? He must judge political theories. By what? He hasn't anything left except his morality. Which means that the individual, in terms of Socrates and the religious developments that we've talked about in the past, ultimately must search his own soul, must search his own heart, and try to be true to himself. And in that effort, he makes his political judgment, he makes his moral judgments, which have a political impact. They become translated into a political stance, and he passes judgment on those whom he has deputed as his agents, as his trustees, to operate the business of the public. He can't do it himself. Not everybody can do that kind of work. There's a division of labor. If everybody attended to the public business full time, the world would come to a standstill. Nobody would go to work in the bakeries, in the factories, in the shops. So there is a division of labor. Some take to public business. Most of us take to private business. But it's those who retain their position in private life who are the judges of what happens in the public life. And I think, by and large today, political theoreticians would agree with that. It is only in a totalitarian society that politics dominates everything, that there is no way of questioning a political decision made in the Kremlin, for example. But outside of a totalitarian society, people do retain their moral judgment, and the moral judgment ultimately must be superior to the political judgment. That, I think, remains as the foundation for an understanding of Locke. And in that sense, Locke is a link in a long chain, which we saw how it began, and the development through the Middle Ages. You find this in Thomas Aquinas, and Richard Hooker, and Althusius, a continuous chain and right through our own time. And this is why it is still relevant and still meaningful to see Locke, to read him, and to be concerned with what he says. Are there any questions before we turn to another topic? Yes, ma'am. Would you please speak up so that we could hear you? Well, first ask one, and then we'll go to the other.